Chapter 8 The Black Sorcerer of the Ashen Forest. The Ashen Forest was black with the night. The stars were hidden to the prisoners by the thick cluster of sentinel bats that circled the trees and the edge of the woodland area. Every now and again a cry from beneath the trees would go out and pierce the deathly night silence. An occasional flash would light up the pitch dark as the great yellow eyes of the soul watchers opened momentarily. The black sorcerer peered from his dark heavy hooded robe into the blackness from his window. Beside him, amongst his ledgers on a writing desk, lay a letter from the custodians of the portals. They were coming to meet with him here. He had been waiting for them, long before their letter arrived. The crystal skull had told him all that would come to pass and he had simply bided his time. He'd waited for the drama to begin so he could play his part, and now the time was upon them all. A flurry of activity signaled the landing of bats in the courtyard of his home. One of them let out a screeching sound and the black sorcerer's eyes narrowed as he received the signal. He sent it back, pulses of energy returning to the large assembly of mammals. It was quiet again as he made his way out onto the porch. When he got occasional breaks in the wing blanket above, he observed the moon half asleep in the night sky and watched as Orion stretched his bow, ready for the war about to break out. The sentinels were on watch. They knew something was in the air. It was in their nature to know. Nature was their ally, the constant rippling energy of information forever moving through the atmosphere, allowing them to know who was coming and what was in their hearts. The bright-eyed crowd parted, their wings fluttering as he entered the throng and positioned himself in the center. He towered above their much smaller forms. They could barely make out his figure, heavily covered in his long black cloak. Against the dark sky he was a black phantom, their eyes fixed on the moving shadows within the black sorcerer's hood, and they listened to his communication, ears vibrating as they received the signals he was transmitting. The crystal skull has informed me that the Osiris prophecy is coming to pass. He began. High-pitched sounds bounced back and forth among the listeners. The excitement was high. The custodians have requested a meeting and they will be here shortly. They want to make an agreement with us. They want us to help them win the war against the human ones. The crowd was hushed now. The black sorcerer held the silence for a few moments. They will come with their clever words. They will come with their trading tools. A scream echoed through the ashen forest and with it came an icy rush of cold air. The black sorcerer raised his head and looked towards the thicket of trees. The prisoners are restless. Even they know something great is coming. The black sorcerer walked slowly among the crowd, deep in thought. He stopped and looked at them. It's almost feeding time, and the prisoners are prepared for feeding, are they not? The crowd nodded with hungry anticipation. Yes, then we'll wait a while. We'll wait until our guests arrive. The custodians will receive the hospitality of the Ashen Forest. They will not be in a position to refuse. The black sorcerer lifted his cape and bade farewell to his followers. He ascended the steps to his home and, turning to face the tree-lined entrance to the Ashen Forest, gave a low chuckle. He'd give them their banquet first. Then, they'd get a grand tour of the woodland prison. Noah and Hassan sat on a bench on the east bank of the Nile while Melissa crouched on the ground in front of them. They were a suspicious-looking bunch, all huddled together over Noah's brown bag, but to the people walking, trading and eating around them, nobody took too much interest in what they were up to. Noah was trying to scoop the sacred white powder into Melissa's water bottle, but there was a slight breeze coming off the river and it was blowing the incredibly light substance in all directions. Noah and Hassan had taken their doses. Poor Hassan was still a bit shell-shocked after hearing their story, but he felt he had no choice but to try to help his friends. Even if they'd lost their minds, at least he could tell himself he'd tried to give them hope. Nick had disappeared somewhere, supposedly using this magical stuff, and unfortunately nobody had any idea where his uncle was. Hassan had found himself in charge of this very strange expedition into the past, and now his studies and good sense would be tested. Melissa swallowed her mixture of water and powder and the three of them settled down, waiting. Just keep focused on the journey of the dead, Noah reminded them. Hassan just shrugged. Lara pictured the Great Pyramid in her mind, She imagined she was sitting within its walls looking up. What did she see? The dodecahedron. Shafts of light created the geometric shape. When she'd taken the journey with the tall man, they had risen up to meet it within a pillar of white light, and then a sound had turned the dodecahedron into golden moments. She'd found herself here in the meadow looking up to Orion. Lara realized that the rock she was sitting on had to be perfectly in line with one of the stars of his belt. That also meant that this was a doorway, a portal, and that by sitting on the rock, she was sitting in an energy field. She closed her eyes and imagined being in a ray of light coming from one of the belt stars. It was gold, and it covered her completely, covered the whole rock, in fact. She imagined sitting in the dodecahedron, and remembered the sound that had turned it gold. She didn't have to make the sound, she could just remember it and replay it in her mind. She focused hard, harder than she'd focused on anything in her life. The sound was there in her mind, it got louder, louder, it was real now. Her body was tingling, she wanted to scratch inside her body, some parts felt itchy. Then she felt light and peaceful. When Lara opened her eyes, she was in a chair, next to an empty one in the gold dodecahedron. The light was very bright and Lara had to shade her eyes, but she was moving downwards and, as she did so, the light faded to silver and then white. She'd moved out of the dodecahedron and was moving down the pillar of light. She found herself on the raised platform in the middle of the Great Pyramid base. She'd done it. Lara leapt into the air and shrieked with joy. Yes! 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 A sudden movement made Lara turn. Far, far into the distance, rising from the crevices where the walls met the floor, dark shadows moved towards her. She turned around, they were coming from all sides. Lara screamed, the dark gatekeepers had found her. She bit at her hand in terror as she looked around. Up ahead from where she was standing was the stairwell that led into the subterranean chamber. She looked at the distance between the dark gatekeepers and herself and tried to judge whether she should run for it. The only alternative was to stay here. She could stay within the beam, and perhaps move up again, but what then? Where would she go? She was in trouble whatever she did. She'd have to take a chance. Blankets of gray and black moved in waves towards her. The dark gatekeepers were getting closer. She jumped off the platform and landed awkwardly on the soil of the floor base. She got up and ran for the stairwell. She slowed as she approached and moved carefully down the narrow steps, afraid of falling and breaking an ankle. It was dark down here, the stairwell seemed to descend forever. Where was the light that had been here last time? After what seemed like an eternity, Lara found herself in the pitch black of the subterranean chamber. Only the smallest flicker of light traveled from the center, and she stumbled around until she tripped over something. Lara hit her head on a hard object and passed out before she could hear the shuffling bodies of the dark gatekeepers and feel their hot, foul breath on her twisted neck. Very different. A moving cloud revealed the crescent moon, and a shaft of light reflected off a building far in the distance across the water. A rather confused Hassan got to his feet, pointed to the light and rubbed his eyes. It's the Great Pyramid. He shouted, look! The moonlight is reflecting off the polished surface. During the Golden Age, it used to be covered with a beautiful polished stone. Hassan fell back down on his knees. My God! We are in the Golden Age. Oh my God! What do we do? Hassan grabbed his head, his hair and his face. He was in such wonder. He looked at Melissa and Noah, looked across the river. Or was it the sea? He spun around, looked at the scenery behind him and grabbed his hair again, his eyes wide with excitement. They were on a bank, but not a river bank, more of a muddy beach. The pyramids, all of them and other buildings, they were visible in the distance, but they seemed to be on a huge hill, an island in the sea. Hassan, please. Noah called. Pull yourself together. Melissa frowned at Noah, but before she could tell him off for being sharp with Hassan, a loud horn sounded. They looked in the direction from which the noise had come, and it came again, a little louder this time. It was obviously getting closer. Looking across the water, they could just about make out a barge, a rather large one at that. There was a figure at the helm they couldn't see clearly. Suddenly there was light. The person was holding up a lamp of some sort and waved it at them. Whoever it was obviously knew they were there, though none of them could figure out how they could be seen on the bank from such a distance without any light. We must wait here, Hassan declared. I know the story of this barge. It is the first part of the journey of the dead. Nick, the teenager, battled with the voices in his head. He tried to keep the idea of the ashen forest in his mind, but the image kept slipping away. The walls were speaking to him, distracting him. Did he recognize the voices? Nick turned to examine the familiar-looking brickwork and found himself standing in the grounds of his old secondary school. He watched as the images of his youth sprang into view and listened to kids shouting greetings or insults as if he'd never been gone. Hey Nicky boy. Nicky nerd. Paula Summers, the most popular, some say prettiest, girl in the school, had been his worst nightmare. Paula was the school mafia boss. Whether you had a good day or not depended on her, and she had the Melrose private school mob on hand any time of day or night to carry out her orders. The mob were made up of Paula's male admirers, those who hoped beyond all pointless hope to get into her good books and catch at least a flirtatious smile, or at most, a kiss and cuddle behind the bicycle sheds. Paula had rewards for all kinds of behavior, and TR, which stood for total rejection, was the worst. If a person was crazy enough to refuse one of Paula's demands, she would declare the poor victim out of favor and TR was the punishment. Not one person in the school spoke to them for as long as the mafia boss decreed. The mob had cornered Nick one morning, the day after an important science test. Passing the test meant one got to go on a trip to London to the Science Museum and stay overnight at a 4-star hotel. Those who failed had to stay behind and attend science study class to catch up before the end of year finals. The mob had waylaid him as he walked to morning assembly. Hey Nicky nerd. Paula needs a favor. Paula had missed school the day before and had been given the opportunity to write the test that morning. She was now demanding that Nick write the questions and answers on a slip of paper and give it to her to take into the examination room. Nick was terrified. Paula was capable of unbearable emotional torture if her orders weren't carried out. He'd had to suffer the taunts of her followers year in and year out as he'd excelled at school in all of his subjects. Paula hated clever people. Amongst a million other wicked things, he'd had nasty things written on his school locker, rotten vegetables stuffed into his school bag, and had endured the horrible experience of having his swimming trunks whipped off him in the school pool while everyone jeered and dared him to get out. Nick never fought back. He didn't like the idea of black eyes. In fact, he just didn't like to argue with people really. This year, she'd made him suffer far less, and there were even times when she'd been quite nice to him. Nick had purposely not done so well in his fourth year at school, and as he had expected, he somehow got on better with the others. Nick was tempted to do as she demanded, yet he knew just what happened to cheats at this rather expensive private school. They had a zero-tolerance attitude, and rumor had it that kids had been expelled in the past for just looking at each other during a test. Even before he could think on the problem, Paula confronted him before the doors of the school assembly hall. Nicky, she'd purred, smiled at him the way Nick had seen her smile at the endless line of boyfriends. Nick could hardly catch his breath. He'd do anything not to get back into her little black book of total rejects, anything to have her smile at him that way. Perhaps she might even get to fancy him just a little bit. Nick had given her the answers, and she'd passed her test. They'd gone to London and, once again, he had been ignored and pushed to the end of the long line of would-be male admirer puppies. Nicky nerd, she'd laughed at him again and again on that very same trip. Nick stood in the school grounds amongst his school memories, feeling the misery of those long ago days. Then, suddenly, he heard an enormous thunderclap. The sky went dark and lightning crackled as it shot across the sky above him. The buildings of the school loomed eerily in the sudden darkness, and as the rain began to pour, she was there, standing before him. Paula Summers was wet through. Her hair clung to her head as rivulets of water ran down her face. And Nick, she was saying something, asking something. Why, Nick? Why did you betray yourself? Why did you all betray me? She seemed to be crying, but it was hard to tell as the rain pelted down even harder. Betray her? Nick was confused. Nobody ever betrayed Paula. Do you know where I ended up, Nick? I'm in prison now. I'm in prison for stealing and harming people. I always took what I could get from everyone, and nobody stood up to me. You are Horace Tasker. You never stood up for yourself. Why, Nick? But Nick didn't know what was happening, but I just didn't want, I know what you didn't want, Nick. You didn't want to be unpopular. You didn't want TR, so you betrayed yourself. You betrayed the Horus Taskers, but I didn't know I was a Horus Tasker. But you were a good person. You were clever and so honest that I hated you. But you let me win. You let me change all that. And why? Because you wanted to be one of us, one of the bad people.
No.
I didn't want to be bad. I just didn't want to be alone. It was just a test, Nick. A test to see if you could keep your power, stop other people stealing it from you by making you do what they wanted you to do. Life sends us many tests. Some people get hard tests, some easier ones. I was a power thief. I bullied people into doing what I wanted. There are many types of power thief in our lives, and bullies are one of them. The test is always to see if we can be ourselves, no matter what. I was a childhood demon that you had to fight so that you could learn to be strong. But you let me win. You never fought back. You made sure that you didn't do quite as well at school, and then you gave me the answers to the science exam. And now look at me. I'm in prison and you, well, you are still the same. Nick blinked. Still the same? What was she talking about? He was a grown man now, and he was an archaeologist. Yes, still the same, Nick. The Egyptologists have the wrong stories about ancient Egypt, and you know it. You know a little of the truth now, but you're afraid to remember the rest. You're still a coward, Nick, pretending you're stupid like the rest of us. You're afraid that if you remember the truth about the Horus Taskers and the Halls of Amenti, you will be rejected. You're scared the old-fashioned Egyptologists will make you suffer, TR. Nick felt the goosebumps rise on his skin. The sky raged and Paula was shouting to be heard. She was right. He was afraid to speak the truth. He dreamed sometimes about the Halls of Amenti, but when he woke up, he wouldn't let himself think about the dreams. When he slept, he'd go places to schools. In the dreams, his teachers would tell him to remember Osiris, Osiris. Remember Osiris in the Halls of Amenti. You should have fought back, Nick, black eyes or not, tear or not. Slowly, your power would have returned. You fight and fight until one day the bullying stops because you have won the battle against your fear. And when you fight back, you teach other frightened people something. You show them that courage wins over in the end. Have the courage now, Nick. Have the courage to remember the story behind the prophecy of Osiris. Teach the children the truth and teach the Egyptologists the truth. Change the way people look at their world, Nick. Oh my. Nick fell to the ground as the power of the memories flooded his mind. He remembered it all, the teachers, the schools, Osiris, the Halls of Amenti. He watched the pictures in his mind. Where had he been? Why had he been so afraid of this knowledge? He traveled through his memories, weaving in and out of time, putting the great story together. Now he understood. No, now he remembered the great duty of the Horus Taskers. Nick returned to the present moment as he felt the sun on his face. He looked up into the face of Paula Summers. She smiled and the sun grew brighter, brighter, until Nick had to shield his eyes. When he opened them again, the walls were back, rushing past him, making him feel as if he were flying forward. The movement stopped. Nick was back to normal again. He was back in his adult body, but he felt different. He felt free, free to uncover and reveal the prophecy of Osiris. He sat down for some time, remembering. Nick suddenly felt a tingling in his chest as he raised his hand. A spark of light shot out from his heart area. The light filled his body. He was enveloped in a bright halo of light that bounced off the walls of the corridors. An image suddenly flashed through his mind, a yellow eye. Nick felt a sudden urgency, the Ashen Forest. He had to get there fast. Something was happening. He closed his eyes and pictured the place as clearly as he could. He focused and focused. Soon, beads of sweat poured from his forehead. It was the wing of a large bat that caused him to open his eyes. Ali Mehmet ran for his life. They were panting like dogs in the distance behind him. No matter which tunnel he'd taken, they were there, wandering, waiting. He dodged in and out of this endless maze, running from them. He called Lara. Lara. But he never seemed to find himself anywhere except within more tunnels that looked the same and were occupied by glittery-eyed black things. Sister Abigail had told him that the dark gatekeepers were not allowed to wander the astral corridors, yet here they were. The man in the black cape had told him the answers were here with the dark gatekeepers. Answers? He didn't know what his questions were. Except one: how do I get out of here? As the question formed in his mind, Ali Mehmet's ears started ringing. Yes. Yes. I'm listening. It was Sister Abigail for sure. Stop, Ali Mehmet. Stop and face them. Stop running from the things that you fear. Ali Mehmet didn't stop. Was the old bush lady mad? Stop. Why should he listen to her? She was wise, but Ali Mehmet continued to run. Stop and face them. You're good inside. If you think happy thoughts, they can't feed off you. They hate light. Happy thoughts are shiny bright thoughts. Feed off me. Feed? Ali Mehmet ran even faster. He pictured their teeth sinking into his leathery skin and rickety old bones up ahead. A black dog-shaped shadow spotted him with eager, glittering eyes. Ali Mehmet turned sharply into another corridor and stopped suddenly. There must have been more than 100 of them. He'd been ambushed. He turned to run back, but they were behind him too. He sunk to the floor, weeping in terror. The black dog-like creatures closed in on him, the reeking breath hot on his face and arms. Ali Mehmet felt a sucking sensation. Slurping sounds filled the tunnel as he grew weaker. Feeding, his body could no longer move. He was paralyzed. Not even his neck could move in his trance-like state. He felt pulling. The dark gatekeepers were taking him somewhere. The wooden barge loomed large in front of them. It had stopped about 100 or so yards from the bank and swayed majestically in the low light of the half-moon. The man at the helm, whose face they could not make out, held the lamp high. Quite suddenly it threw out an enormous amount of light. The white rays reached them on the bank and seemed melissa to make the three of them glow like angelic beings. His gravelly voice traveled with the beams from his lantern and filled the halo of light that surrounded them. Welcome to the astral planes, the pathways to power. I am Thoth, the crossing guard of the celestial waterways. To alight the boat, you must open the first portal with your knowledge. Until I have posed my question to you, this light will protect you from the dark ones. The three of them recoiled as black figures rose from the water about 50 yards away. These creatures moved to form a semicircle around them. Melissa felt a shiver run up her spine and she grabbed the arms of both Noah and Hassan. Do not fear the dark gatekeepers, for they have no power over you if you possess light. I am Thoth, bringer of light. Light is knowledge, light is wisdom. All of you have the wisdom of this journey written inside of you, but you have to unlock the doors to that wisdom. If you remember your wisdom, your light will shine and no dark creature can harm you. If you choose not to remember, however, then the dark gatekeepers will take you away. You will become a prisoner of the Ashen Forest and later their food. At the first gate, you will make a decision which path you will take. Noah eyed the black shadows warily. They edged forward, advancing on the three of them. His mother's eyes were closed now. She couldn't look as the wobbling dog-like figures approached the wide perimeter of light that surrounded them. Hassan's eyes nearly popped out of their sockets as he watched the creature's teeth fangs drip with black slobber. The dark gatekeepers stopped short, about 30 yards from them. They made rasping sounds, turning their backs and edging away. Noah nudged his mother. You can open your eyes, Mum. They can't come any closer. They don't like the light. Melissa slowly raised her eyelids and peered into the shadowy darkness beyond. Her stomach still lurched at the sight of the dark demons, but she calmed a little when she saw them all turning away and moving back. A horn sounded, then another, and another. A symphony of sounds began, and as they did, the sky lit up just around the barge to reveal the figure. A shuffling of bodies and rasps came from the darkness. The creatures moved further into the blackness. At the sight of the figure in the light, Melissa gave a gasp and Hassan fell to his knees, holding his hands together as if in prayer. Noah shaded his eyes with his hands and peered under them to get a better look in the glare of light. A figure was a man. Well, he had a man's body, but his head was that of some sort of bird? Geez! Noah exclaimed. What the, it's Thoth, his head is that of an ibis. Hassan explained excitedly. Thoth spoke. I welcome you, blessed Horus Taskers. I am Thoth, the bringer of knowledge. This is the beginning of your journey and I am here to tell you of the challenges ahead. You are about to take the journey of the Duat. This is part of a journey in which you have to find the answers to a series of riddles. The answer to each riddle will be a piece of a story, and you have to slowly build the story in order to find what you are looking for. But before you can do that, you have to know what you are looking for, and the answer to this will get you through the first portal, the Great Waterway. All Horus Taskers have 12 keys encoded in their bodies. These keys are the answers to questions. To get through the portals, you have to remember the key codes and tell them to the white gatekeepers. Some of you already possess a number of keys without realizing it. And there are some keys you still have to discover. All of you are different. If you remember them, your body will become filled with light as the doors to the halls of Amenti open. It is time that you remember your beginnings and your great knowledge. You will begin by remembering why you are taking this journey. If you do not remember, it is because you choose not to. If forgetfulness is your choice, then you cannot pass over the Great Waterway and the Dark Gatekeepers will claim you. There was silence as the three of them looked at each other. It's pretty obvious, isn't it? Noah shrugged. We're here to rescue Lara. Melissa frowned. Hadn't she given this answer to Selene at the Sphinx earlier this evening? Hassan gestured for Noah to speak on their behalf. Noah squinted as he looked up. Well, we're here for Lara. We're doing our best to find her, and we were told to take the path of the Duat. Your answer does not allow you to alight the barge. But why? Why won't you let us on? It is not I, but you who decides your fate. I am here to serve those who take this journey, but to take it, you have to answer the questions correctly. All I can do is try to encourage you to remember the answer. Lara's disappearance started this adventure for you. She gave you a reason to begin it. Though you need to find her, she is not the true reason you are taking this journey. The three of them looked at each other with alarm, then Hassan looked to the floor and thought. Noah scratched his head. He looked puzzled. Deeper they were looking for Lara, yes, but why? Melissa recalled the stories Lara had told her through the dreaming crystal. The Horus Taskers are on a journey to find their power. I think I know the answer. Melissa hissed at the other two. She didn't know why she was trying to speak quietly. We're Horus Taskers, we're looking for power, right? Yes, Hassan answered, but there's more. Give it to us. Noah said, looking into the blackness, keeping guard. Otherwise we're going to be somebody's supper. Horus is the son of Osiris, Hassan continued. I feel the answer lies somewhere in the story of Osiris because Thoth mentioned the halls of Amenti. Where, what are they? Melissa asked, concentrating on Hassan's face. Knowing the dark gatekeepers were lurking in the shadows made her focus very powerfully. The halls of Amenti are where Osiris lives. Thoth says that if we find the keys, that is, if we answer the riddles, we bring in light from the halls of Amenti. So Osiris gives us light. Are we supposed to be looking for Osiris, then? Noah was desperate for an answer. The thought of not figuring out this clue was too horrible to entertain. Yes, but we need to answer the question why. Hassan pondered. If you remember our earlier conversation, Osiris ruled the earth, and when his brother Seth killed him, the earth and human beings went to rack and ruin. On Osiris' death, Seth chopped him up into pieces, 14 to be precise, and hid them all over Egypt. Isis, his wife, was determined to bring her husband back to life, and so went in search of Osiris' body parts. She found all except his phallus. She made an artificial one and put it on his dead body. Then, she got pregnant with Horus. Osiris came back to life and went to live among the stars. Orion, as you know, is his home. So? Noah pressed. The whole story is a hieroglyph. A hieroglyph? But hieroglyphs are ancient Egyptian letters, aren't they? A hieroglyph is a symbol. A symbol stands for something, replied Hassan. Yeah, like on road signs, Noah said. A picture of a zigzagging line means the road is slippery. Precisely, Noah. Hassan paused for a moment before continuing. But the ancient Egyptians were trying to tell us a story, the story of how we all got here, the story of human creation. So they left us hieroglyphs that were arranged to tell the story of Osiris. The point is, The story itself is a hieroglyph. You've lost me, Hassan, Noah said. How can a story be a hieroglyph? I'll answer that, Noah, Melissa piped up. You know those riddle games you like to play, the lateral thinking puzzles? The one time, I began by telling you that a carrot and two pieces of coal were lying in a field. Then I asked you how they got there. Your task was to work out the riddle by asking me questions to which I could only answer yes or no. Do you remember the answer to that riddle? Noah? Of course. I did that one with Lara. By the time we'd asked you 1,000 questions, we fitted the story together. It turned out that it had snowed the week before and some kids had built a snowman. They'd used two pieces of coal for the snowman's eyes and a carrot for his nose. The following week, the snow had melted, leaving the coal and carrot lying in the field. Do you see now? Melissa continued. The riddle was a hieroglyph. There was a story behind the picture of the carrot and the coal. Got it. Noah chirped. He got it very clearly. Carry on, Hassan. Hieroglyphs can be read in layers. What I mean is, you can look at the hieroglyphs and tell the story. Then, you take the story, and ask yourself what the real story is behind the story. You now have handling it rather like your lateral thinking puzzles. You look at all the characters and try to figure out what they are doing in the story. But why would anyone tell a story in such a difficult way, Hassan? Melissa was intrigued, but confused. They would hide a story within a story if the story was top secret stuff. That is, they'd hide the story in a situation where if it were told straight out, the storyteller would be arrested and killed. What are you actually getting at, Hassan? Noah asked, leaning forward. Are you saying that the story of Osiris isn't what we think, that we have to look at the characters and find out what the true meaning is? I'm saying exactly that. Ah! Melissa cried. I see what you're saying, Hassan. We are searching for the truth about who we are, and the truth lies in the story of Osiris. It suggests that human beings are not what we think we are. That something happened where we lost our power, and the story somehow tells us how we can regain that power. Bingo! On this journey we'll find out, and we can then tell others. Hassan shouted proudly. Before Hassan could call out the answer, a great spark of light shot out from the heart area of all three of them, making them glow even brighter than before. Suddenly, they found themselves moving up the shaft of light towards Thoth's lantern. Then they were seated in the middle of the strangely scooped out vessel, amidst an assembly of men with animal heads. Noah didn't mind their strange faces and clothing. He was glad to leave those black shadows behind for the time being. Abdul Bakr stood on the floor of the Great Pyramid, watching as the migrants floated down the light column in pairs. The light had a dirty green glow, and the sound that transported them was more of a low drone than a hum. Abdul Bakr needed a team. This new lot were his people, all of them from the same planet that blew up. They were desperate for entry into this world. They lived as guests on a neighboring planet. Those planetary inhabitants were ugly great things, hulking green lizards who looked like men, and unfortunately his team looked just the same. They'd been begging to get in for 1,000 years or so, but the 12 custodians did not let too many of their own in. They were greedy. They'd wanted the world, the slaves and all the goodies the slaves created for themselves. Too many of them would have been dangerous. The custodians would have ended up fighting for power against teams of their own people. No thanks. It had been best to keep them all out, except for a few who were around the world, doing the dirty work. But that was then. This was now. Now that Abdul Bakr was going to take over, he'd better pick his own men. They were going to bump off the current custodians, so they still didn't have to share. He couldn't see Seth's group obeying him after Seth became green goo. The chief aide would never listen to a thing Abdul Bakr would have to say. No, Abdul Bakr was clear on what had to be done. He had to devise a plan to send them all on their way to the great graveyard in the sky. One by one the newcomers filed down the stairs of the platform. Their green scaly forms were grotesque. They wouldn't win any beauty competitions. Abdul Bakr would have to deal with the way they looked when the other custodians were dead. For now, they had their own tonic. Like the custodians, they also switched when things went wrong, Their bodies were also made from borrowed DNA. Abdul Bakr would have to see to it that this ugly bunch didn't get themselves in a flap. They were revolting enough as it was, without turning into green goo to cap it all. They stood in a line. Abdul Bakr counted. 12. His team. He puffed up with pride as he instructed them to address him as Your Grace. After lecturing them on their new duties, he sent them back onto the platform. They were all to meet in another place. They had work to do, a lot of very dirty work. Chapter 9 Ghosts of the Past. The nine aides were seated around a large table roughly carved from a huge ancient tree of the Ashen Forest. It was positioned in a clearing next to which hulking trees huddled close together, listening, spying. The chief aide shuddered quietly, his eyes scouring the trees for movement every now and again. A scream echoed through the eerie silence and flashes of yellow light lit the thicket momentarily as the watchful eyes blinked at the sounds of fear. The group didn't speak. Their wary eyes searched the darkness around them. The dim candles flickered on the tables, their wax creeping like bony fingers along the surface of the wood, but the light was poor. The sky occasionally lit up as those sinister winged things flapped suddenly in unison, revealing the moon and making the aides jump from their tree stump stools. Their master had insisted they all come here to see the black sorcerer. Why His Grace imagined they needed his help was unimaginable. Things had to be really bad for them all to be here in this unforgiving place. The table was set for supper, but nobody was hungry, even though they hadn't eaten in many hours. Their master was with the black sorcerer as they spoke, and others were preparing dinner. Fresh food for my guests. The black sorcerer had ordered fresh from the woodland prison. I expect my guests to eat and drink. The chief aide felt sick. If they didn't banquet with this creature, their master, Seth, would take his anger out on them. They'd have to eat well. It was unthinkable to even put his mind on the food they would receive. Somebody was coming. No, it sounded like a number of people dragging something. All the aides' heads were turned in the direction of the sounds. They squinted in the dark as the forms, vaguely lit by some kind of lamplight, trampled through the wooded thicket. The food had arrived. The crystal skull was perched between the two of them. Seth eyed it from time to time as the black sorcerer communicated through it. A single candle gave off a sparse light from a nearby window frame. But Seth wasn't about to complain. He didn't need to see the creature opposite him. Thank you very much. There was enough to think about without having to look into the face of this liquid crystal moved as the skull translated the sounds that came from the black sorcerer, giving him a voice. So, the prophecy of Osiris is unfolding. What precisely do you want of me? I ask, Seth said unsteadily. He was not used to asking anyone for anything. I ask that you assist us in arresting the Horus Taskers. You want us to arrest them? The black sorcerer was secretly amused. They are roaming the astral planes, trying to uncover the prophecy. How do you know that? Because the prophecy states that the only way for them to find the truth of the prophecy of Osiris is to use the astral route. And they got past two of my aides. They've disappeared. Your aides? They are dead? I'm sure of it. Another aide, a third, is planning something. He is working against us, I suspect. You don't know what is going on, do you? The black sorcerer leaned forward on the table. How can you ask for help when you do not know what is going on? Seth was speechless. He felt anger rising in his chest, frustration. He reached for his tonic. You do know one thing, the black sorcerer said, sitting back in his chair. You know that something has shifted. The winds of change are upon you. I sense the vibes in the air. I understand it here. The black sorcerer pointed to his head region. Seth took a few slugs of the liquid from his flask. The Horus Taskers are strong people. Osiris has a powerful presence here right now. How did they get past you, Seth? The black sorcerer was enjoying himself. Seth was arrogant. He saw himself as king of the world. Now, the man was feeling small. Mere humans had fooled the great Seth. You can help, Seth said, swallowing hard. Why would I? Because you get to keep the Ashen Forest, that's why. Seth was rattled. If it wasn't for my presence in the human world, this place wouldn't be here. People end up here because they try to get through the doorways to the heavens. Your astral gatekeepers catch them and keep them here. If Osiris returns, the forest will no longer be. You and I need each other. You do not understand who I am, Seth, the black sorcerer said calmly. You seem to have no idea. You are darkness, that's what, Seth spat. He didn't like the tone of this conversation. The black sorcerer wasn't jumping to his assistance. I am a creation of the darkness of the soul, Seth. I am what you create. I am what those humans create. I am their prison guard, because they need me to be. What was this thing talking about? Seth didn't have a clue. I need your help. Are you going to help me? I'll be whatever all of you create. I am your darkness. I serve you. Seth threw his hands up in the air. What does that mean? Whoever finds their way here is trapped by their fear. They need a place to act out their fear. Their fear makes pictures in the astral. You know the astral, don't you, Seth? You know how it makes pictures of your thoughts? Seth knew. He and his aides controlled the astral. Well, sort of. They'd put gatekeepers there, to trap human souls he kept well away from it. It was a place that magnified your thoughts, good or bad. They somehow created pictures of things that were in your mind. Which was scary for Seth. He didn't know how to have pleasant thoughts. It wasn't in his nature. He was one of those people who were just plain, well, wicked. The astral is just another version of the world, Seth, the black sorcerer said, except the world creates the mind's pictures in a different way. In the world, whatever we think, we create, by bringing people into our lives who create good or bad experiences for us. Seth sighed. Well, I want to get rid of these Horus Taskers and stop this whole prophecy from coming to pass. I'd like it if you could send more dark gatekeepers out to the astral pathways to arrest them. They'd never get past great armies of those things. You haven't understood a thing, Seth. It makes no difference how many we send. If the Horus Taskers find their power, they will beat all of us. If they are weak-minded, we get them here. The black sorcerer again leaned across the table. You know what, Seth? Seth narrowed his eyes suspiciously. He wasn't sure what was coming. Those Horus Taskers have an advantage over you. And do you know why? Seth was silent, riveted. They have the advantage because they are learning about authentic power. You only know how to steal it. Seth and the black sorcerer sat in silence for what seemed a very long moment. Sister Abigail bellowed her message, her voice bouncing off every cell, rattling every bone in Lara's body. Lara. Wake up! Wake up! Wake up! Lara opened her eyes and found herself leaning against the eucalyptus tree. Her head hurt and her neck felt a bit stiff. She squinted against the sun and groaned. Lara. She sat up sharply to the sound of Sister Abigail's rather cross tone. For goodness sake. Lara, you're about to be hauled off to the Ashen Forest. Get a grip of yourself. Sister Abigail stood over Lara, her face stony, her eyes popping out of her head. You can't stay here. I just had to get your attention somehow. Sister Lara's head ached. Lara, don't talk, just listen. They're all around your body. They're sucking up your energy so that you'll become paralyzed. Bring in light like I taught you. Light, just do it, Lara. Now. Lara struggled to get her senses together. She closed her eyes again. Light. With her mind, she saw a shaft of gold light pour into the top of her head. She imagined the light getting stronger, pouring in, filling her body and expanding out from her body in a great halo. The light got stronger and stronger, she poured and poured light in. Lara opened her eyes to the dim subterranean chamber. Her cheek was flat against the floor. The demons, or whatever they were crouching in the shadows, hiding from something. She lifted her aching head and straightened her neck. They crouched further as the dim light moved. She looked around for the source. There was no candle or light bulb, no. It was her own light. She'd filled her body and it was radiating light. They were afraid. Of her, of Lara. Lara rubbed her neck and head, all the while watching the creatures who hovered at the borders of the light that surrounded her. Her ears began ringing. Sister Abigail, Lara. Keep the light going. You are already powerful. You have to try to find your way to the others who are in the Ashen Forest. The others are busy discovering the keys of Amenti. All of you have to somehow get together. When you do, you must share the keys, share your experiences. Some will have learned, others will not. You have to help each other to find Osiris. All of you have to make the prophecy of Osiris come to pass. Lara took a deep breath. She closed her eyes and took more light into her body. Then she got up. They were creepy, these things, but she was suddenly unafraid. They couldn't hurt her if she kept calm and saw this situation as a game she had to play in the right way. She knew about the story of Osiris, but wasn't sure of the full meaning just yet. She had to find the others, make sure they found all the keys. So, what did she do now? Lara looked around her for a long moment, then climbed the steps back up to the pyramid floor. Nick lay in the semi-darkness, surrounded by trees, the smell of mouldering damp in the air. Someone was watching him. He could feel eyes boring into him. He sat up. There were things in the trees. Suddenly something brushed past his face, making him jump to his feet in fright. Something stood behind a nearby tree. It was quite large, about 2 feet off the ground. Nick could just about make out a form. His heart thudded in his chest. The thing moved. Something fluttered wings. Nick thought quickly, was he going to stand here terrified, jumping at every sound? No. Nick moved towards the trees slowly at first and then ran for the form. Nick shrieked at the top of his voice as he came face to face with the BAT. It was a gigantic thing compared with a flying variety Nick had seen soaring out of caves. This was the size of a small child, and it cowered, backing off from him. The light years Nick realized he had taken in more light, the more he understood about the prophecy of Osiris, the more light he radiated. The light kept bad things away. Nick took a few bold steps towards the bat. It slunk further back, eventually turning, raising its wings and flying off through the trees. There wasn't much light, but Nick trampled through the thicket in the direction the bat had flown. Every now and again his blood froze with the sounds of screams that pierced his ears. There were flashes of yellow light that accompanied the cries. Nick did not know what he was going to find. All he did know was that whatever it was, he had to face it. He kept walking, occasionally stumbling upon a slippery, mossy rock or over the gnarled exposed roots of ancient trees. A noise caused him to stop suddenly. There was an eruption in the dark sky above. The blackness broke up like tearing paper. Nick realized that bats were everywhere. Something was happening. They knew he was approaching. There was a smell. It was sharp metallic blood. Up ahead was a break in the trees. Nick moved faster. It was a clearing. Something was going on as he approached. Nick slowed down. There was movement, then a loud scream and yellow light eyes. Nick crouched behind a tree and peered into the clearing. Dimly lit by candles, were rows of Nick narrowed his eyes to get better focus boxes. No cages. There were things in the cages, animals. Nick crept further forward. He needed to see more clearly. He crouched down. People were there, two people. No, they were bats, walking bats. They were dragging something. They threw it into a cage. Then IT shrieked, "No, no. Please. No. No, hurt me. No, A, eat me. Ha." The terrified voice pleaded in vain. Nick gasped. It was human. It. Nick knew the voice. It was Ali Mehmet. Hussein, Noah and Melissa found themselves standing in front of the Sphinx, only it didn't look like the one they knew. It was facing in the right direction but mounted on a huge building, a gigantic round temple of some sort. In fact, everything looked strange. Hussein pointed to the three great pyramids. Apart from being shiny and new, they were on a rather high-leveled hill overlooking everything. There were other temples and buildings, but this one was powerful. The Sphinx was just ornamentation by the looks of it. The boat had taken them across the water to the island on which the pyramid sat. Thoth had lowered them into shallow water, and they'd waded onto the bank. They walked a short distance to the Sphinx building. It wasn't difficult to know the route directly to its doors, because a great granite pathway led the way from the place the boat had stopped. In addition, silver lions marked the route, as if to remind them where they were headed. And yet, when they got there, they'd thought they were in the wrong place, until Noah had looked up and saw the great lion perched up in the sky on top of the circular temple. There wasn't anybody around, strangely enough. It didn't even look as if the place was, or ever had been, inhabited. The Sphinx building had gigantic silver doors inlaid with beautiful star designs. The whole sky was copied onto this door and it reflected the low moonlight beautifully. As the three of them stood there marveling at the new sights, a sudden sliding sound drew their attention to the doors. They were moving, sliding open. The doors stood apart, revealing a vast space within the walls of the marble interior. The three of them stood still, unsure what to do, when a figure appeared at the entrance. It was a woman, or should they say a cat woman. Celine. Melissa smiled to herself and then sighed. She hoped to pass through this time. Celine stepped out and beckoned them to come up to the doors. Welcome, she smiled as they approached. I'm Celine. She turned and walked into the building. Hesitantly, they followed, walking into an immeasurable space that was certainly bigger on the inside than it appeared on the outside. Celine stopped again and turned to them. Before you move through the portal, you have to walk the labyrinth. She pointed to the white floor, and explained what was expected of them. Embedded in the white marble was a black stone pathway winding into the distance, turning in on itself backwards and forwards again and again like the longest piece of twisting, turning spaghetti lying on a plate. It wiggled up and down, around and about until it reached a point in the middle of the temple. The black stone, Celine told them, was hematite. The spirit of the hematite crystal will help you remember. We have to follow it? Noah asked Celine, going over to the beginning of the path and peering down at it. It'll take us forever in this place. But you have forever, Noah. This is the astral plane. Time does not exist here. Noah frowned, trying to get the dimensions of the place into his head. Somehow he felt that things were not normal in this dimension. Not normal at all. Celine, Hassan asked hesitantly. Is this Heliopolis? The city of gold? His eyes shone. The Egyptologist in him was curious and pleasantly mystified. No, Hassan. She replied gently. Heliopolis is just beyond the portal. It is not of the human dimension or the astral. It belongs in Orion. In the sky? Hassan was whispering in awe. That's just how it looks, Hassan, Celine said smiling. But we live just beyond the great doorway. You are from Orion? Asked Hassan. Yes. The great lion tells you that, surely? We are the cat people. But what? Too many questions, Hassan. Celine said firmly. You have work to do. All your questions will be answered in good time. Now. All of you. Walk the path. I will meet you at the center. The three of them looked at Celine, then at each other. One by one, they began the journey of the hematite labyrinth. Horrified, Nick waited in the dark shadows until the sentinel bats had disappeared. Ali Mehmet lay in his cage moaning softly. Nick crept through the thicket, into the clearing. The smell was foul. All around him were cages. People lay in them, hunched up, dirty, scabbed and thin. And they smelled terribly. He tried to hold his breath, but soon realized he'd just have to get used to the odors of this awful place. He reached Ali Mehmet and, still hunched down, looked into the cage. The old man lay flat out, eyes closed, moaning. Ali Mehmet. Nick hissed in the darkness. Ali Mehmet recoiled in his cage, whimpering in the corner, like an animal. Ali Mehmet. It's Nick. There was quiet in the cage for a moment. Then Ali Mehmet opened his eyes slowly. He whined this time and rolled flat onto his stomach, looking up at Nick through sorry-looking eyes. Ali Mehmet, what happened to you? The dark gatekeepers. They take me. Ali Mehmet's voice was a little too loud. SSHH. Keep quiet, old man. I'm here to help you. Nick was certain those great yellow eyes could see everything. Why else would they open whenever people screamed? Were they checking that nobody was interfering, that there were not rescuers like Nick about? He'd better be careful, keep Ali Mehmet calm. Ali Mehmet. Don't speak. It's Nick. I'm here to help you. If you make any noise, They'll come back for you. Nick's longtime friend lay quietly in the cage. At least he'd understood, Nick thought thankfully. But what now? What was he going to do with Ali Mamet? Nick couldn't leave him here. Someone was coming, Nick whispered sharply to the old man. Ali Mamet. Someone's coming. I'll be back for you. With that, Nick shot back into the trees. Sentinel bats, four of them, shuffled to one of the cages. They opened it and pulled someone out. It was a woman, as far as Nick could see. They hauled her onto a long wooden bench situated right in the center of the clearing. Her head hung limply off the end of the bench while one of the sentinels sunk his teeth into her neck. There was a slurping sound, and the next sentinel took up his position and did the same. Nick suddenly got it. Vampire bats. That's what they were. They fed off animal blood and human blood by the looks of it. When the four of them had finished feeding, they took the woman back to her cage. They looked in the direction of Ali Mehmet's cage and made some strange sounds. One of them lifted a wing pointing towards him. Luckily, they turned and headed off in the opposite direction, back where they came from. Nick spied a wheelbarrow at the edge of the clearing and crept over to it. It contained a load of vegetables. They smelled slightly off. He tipped the barrow over, offloading the vegetables onto the hard soil. He pushed it over to Ali Mehmet's cage and set it down, while he went to open the iron grill door. It wasn't locked, why should it be? Did they get rescuers here on a regular basis? Nick didn't think so, Ali Mehmet. He called softly. Ali Mehmet, I'm back. The old man looked up, turning his head. I don't move, Nick, Ali Mehmet said quietly. I'm not able to move. My body stopped moving. He lay there looking up at Nick. But Ali Mehmet, you'd better move, or else you're going to be supper for these bats. Nick didn't know what to think. Was the old man going crazy? Someone screamed again, the yellow light flashed and Nick saw it clearly. The eye, the yellow eye, appeared as transparent as a ghost in the clearing and flashed open then closed again. Did it see him? Nick stood upright, he looked around him, then bent down to the cage. Ali Mehmet. Come on. You were fine a few minutes ago. You're scared, that's all. That's all? The voice made Nick jump around, and when he saw the figure in front of him he fell to the ground in fright. It was a tall form, in a long black robe. He couldn't see this person's face clearly, but two dark yellow button-like eyes shone brightly within the hood. A see-through skull dangled from the neck of the robed man. It had some sort of moving liquid in it. The creature with the yellow eyes reached down to Nick and stretched out a hand, only it wasn't a hand, it was a bat's wing with long bony fingers extending from the edge of it. He was offering to help Nick up from the ground. Nick looked momentarily at the fingers and backed away, then he raised himself up to stand in front of the hooded figure. Hello, Nick. Nick didn't reply. He was trying to make sense of the voice. It didn't seem to come from the hood, but from the skull? This is the crystal skull, Nick. He translates my sounds into human words. And he lets me know what is going on in all the worlds of this great universe. I am a black sorcerer. This ashen forest belongs to me. Nick didn't answer. He peered into the hood. The black sorcerer reached up with his hands and pushed his hood back. Nick gasped and stepped back. The person's rounded man's head was covered with fine fur and two large ridged ears stood up stiffly from his temples. A strange-looking pug nose lay flat amongst folds of skin on his face and sharp teeth curved from pink gums in a cleft mouth. He was sort of half-man and half-bat, by the looks of his body, but Nick reckoned this creature's face and teeth were all vampire bat. Yes, Nick, that's what I am. A vampire bat with quite a bit of a human in me. Well, what else do you expect when I feed off human beings? Only everything we eat we eventually become right. Even if it does take thousands of years for us to make the changes. All my people, they feed only from human beings, they are like me. What do you want from me? Nick was afraid. All this talk of feeding was making him nervous, especially after what he had seen earlier. Not your blood, Nick, that's for sure. I'm well fed for the night though if I get peckish. The black sorcerer looked towards Ali Mehmet and made a licking sound with his tongue. Nick's skin crawled. But I'll give you the chance to take him first, Nick.
What do you mean?
You're going to free him?
Who am I to free him?
Who are you to free him, Nick?
Only this friend of yours can free himself.
Is this a joke, then?
Nick asked, his irritation now bigger than his fear.
Are you making fun of us?
No, Nick.
No jokes.
You can take this man if he frees himself.
The joke is that you think that you can free him.
Human arrogance is wonderful to observe.
I cannot keep him here, and neither can you free him.
This is a lesson you must learn.
One of the keys of a mentee.
You know about that?
Who are you?
Nick was intrigued.
Was this a good guy or bad guy?
What was he?
I'm whatever you want me to be, Nick.
I serve all who need me.
I am a creation of the human mind.
But nobody wants this.
Nobody wants to end up here and have their blood sucked by vampires.
I'm sure they don't, Nick, but they create it just the same.
Nick wasn't sure he understood.
So I can take Ali Mehmet?
Clearly, you do not understand.
But there's nothing like experience to make you see the truth.
Go on then, Nick.
Save your friend.
Nick looked warily at the man bat. He turned to Ali Mehmet and after one more glance over his shoulder, reached into the cage for his friend.
Melissa felt as if she were coming apart at the seams.
Her body wanted to explode into billions of atoms and fly off in all directions. But she held on.
Let go, Melissa.
A familiar warm voice gave her comfort. She continued walking, following the hematite path, winding round and round. She'd lost all sense of the other two. They'd started off in single file along the path, but they'd somehow lost track of each other. Everything kept changing her thoughts. The scenery, she was at school kindergarten, she was 3 years old.
Four.
She was standing in a corner, facing the walls of the toddler's school. She was not allowed to look at the other children. She sobbed uncontrollably, but it didn't do any good.
This is what happens to children who tell lies, but I didn't lie, Mrs. Templeman.
Fairies don't exist, Melissa, except in fairy tales.
Didn't your mother ever tell you that?
But there's one standing on your shoulder right now, Mrs. Templeman. I'm going to speak to your parents.
Young lady, you're insolent as well as a liar.
Little Melissa cried as she watched the fairies wave her goodbye. They were leaving her, yet they were her friends when she turned. Some of the other kids were waving at them too.
Melissa had invited them in from the nursery garden so the other little ones could see them. They'd had such fun. The fairies tickled the kids and fooled around until Mrs. Templeman realized what was going on and started yelling.
Try as she might, Melissa could not get the teacher to see her friends, and now she was in trouble for persuading the others to see something that Mrs. Templeman said was really not there.
It's dangerous, Melissa, to imagine such things. People will lock you up in a prison and throw away the key.
Don't you know that?
You'd better learn now, my girl, before you grow up to be a complete and utter mad woman.
Melissa had always hated being singled out. She'd always been the good girl at school, and now she was here, disgraced before all her little friends.
The shame was unbearable, and she nearly collapsed with her grief.
But Mrs. Templeman said she needed to learn here and now. She would stay in that corner all day. And she was not to eat lunch with the others all week. And learn she did. The pain in her heart, the separation from the others, was more than she could bear. Melissa had never seen another fairy since that day. Catwoman wouldn't let them through the portal. These cat people seemed to think they knew everything about him. Noah felt a tap on his shoulder. He turned, startled. It must be Cat. Oh no.
What?
It was himself.
It was Noah.
But how?
Hi, Noah.
His double was a cheerful soul. Noah looked aghast at his mirror image and then quickly looked around to see if the cat lady was playing some kind of trick on him. Nobody was around. Hassan had disappeared, so had his mother. It was just this whole no.
It was changing.
He was in a jungle.
Broad, towering trees hanging with rope like creeper met at great heights, and thick green plants of different varieties sprung out of the ground at every angle. It was closed in, wet and hot, yet the hematite path wound on, clear and untouched by the jungle, Noah looked back at his double. Who the bezoos are you? Who do you think? Noah felt beads of sweat forming on his brow. They ran down the side of his face. Strange. The exact same thing was happening to his double. It was like looking in a mirror. Well, you can't be me. I'm me. Well, I'm you too. What's going on? Have I finally lost my mind? That's it, isn't it? I'm a lunatic like my sister. We've all gone mad, even poor Hussein. Noah wiped the side of his head with his arm. The rivers of sweat on his double's face disappeared. I don't know. Are you mad? Is this a riddle? I don't know. Is it? Noah breathed hard. You're crazy. Which means that you are. Well, if I wasn't balmy before, you're doing a good job of shaking up my marbles now. Noah turned from his double and walked into the undergrowth. He didn't know where he was going, but then again, did he ever? Stick to the path, Noah. Noah stopped and looked down. He stood on some mossy turf, next to the hematite track. He stepped back onto it. Keep going, Noah. Huh? With your smart aleck remarks. Keep going, boy, you're entertaining me. What are you on about? Keep talking. Fill your head with nonsense. Stupid remarks. Jokes. Tough guy talk. Don't get serious, will you? Noah looked at his double quizzically, but didn't say anything. He just turned around and started walking on the path. Maybe this dream thing would end and he'd find Hassan and his mother. Cap, got your tongue? Noah jumped back as his double swung upside down in front of him, suspended from a tree branch. How did you? Who are you, Noah? A Noah? Smart remark. Clever. Keep going so you don't have to find out why I'm here. I already know. It's a test to see if you can mess with my head. Well, you might as well try something else. I'm not going nuts for you. Noah pushed past his double and kept walking. Aha. Mr. Know-all as well as Mr. Smart remarks and Mr. Overconfident. Noah frowned. He didn't like this. He didn't understand it. He stopped and turned to face his double, but he was gone. Noah swung around. Nothing but jungle. Disturbed, he turned and walked slowly at first, then fast. His double had gone. He'd obviously passed some sort of test, so when was he going to get out of this place? The path, although clear on the ground, was getting a little crowded at shoulder level. Bushes and tree branches leaned over as if deliberately trying to get in Noah's way. He shoved them to one side and then found himself in front of a giant spider's web. Noah's double dangled in the middle and the great thing blocked his path. The double was wrapped up in cotton cloth? No. Spider's silk. He looked powder white. Dead. He was suspended amongst many other creepy crawly things, all wound up in the deadly network of silken threads. He couldn't be lifeless, though. Noah knew that much. Spiders just paralyzed their prey, they didn't kill them off. Not right away, anyway. They kept them alive and fresh, so they didn't go off. Geez, Louise, Noah breathed. What now? Was he supposed to get up there and rescue his double? He didn't fancy ending up as spider's bait. He knew about these web things. They were made with the stickiest gluey substance on the planet. He'd never get out if he tried to get in. So? What to do? Noah looked around him. He caught sight of a long broken tree branch in the low bushes. He walked over to it and picked it up. It was long enough to poke at his double and see if he could get a response. Noah stepped over rocks and tree stumps, trying to get a side view of the web and its dangling prisoners. It was a bit difficult to get to him without getting stuck himself, but if he climbed the tree from which one side of the web began, he could get level with his double. The tree was knobbly with age, and was easy to climb. He got to the branch that he had aimed for and crept along its thick, heavy arm. Balancing carefully, Noah stopped as he got to the edge. The web was poised between two trees and hung beautifully and dangerously. A noise caused Noah to swing around. As he did so, He stared straight into the eyes of a giant daddy long-legs spider. Noah edged back then lost his footing. He tumbled from the tree but before he reached the ground, he found himself bouncing then swinging. He went on like this until the movement slowed. When it had stopped he tried to move his arms, but they were stuck. He looked down. He was caught in the spider's web with his double. They were lying top to toe. Hassan sat on the wooden chair. It had just appeared on the hematite path, getting in the way of his walk. He had looked at it for a while, and then decided to sit down. Climbing over it and getting on with the walk didn't seem quite the right thing to do. It faced the direction he had just walked from. Maybe this was a test. What test, he couldn't imagine. But the ancient students of the temples, the initiates, had gone through lots of tests, and so maybe this was one of them. He sat for a long time. He crossed his arms, scratched his head, twiddled his thumbs, yawned a few times and then whistled tunelessly. After a while, the wooden slats were making his bottom hurt, so he got up and rubbed it. "Gross," came a voice. Hassan swung round to face the chair. "Stop scratching your bum." An old lady with small rounded glasses and hair twisted in a bun glared at Hassan. They were no longer in a great building, but on a bridge, overlooking a stream. "I'm not. My buttocks were a little cramped. I'm just rubbing if you don't mind. Please watch your language. Only if you watch your manners. Who are you, anyway? Where did you come from? Where are we? Are you a test?" Hassan looked around him at the scenery. There was daylight. It was a vast green lush landscape of, in fact, weren't they outside the Sphinx building again? But he turned to the woman and back again. There was grass, trees, vegetation. "But this is Egypt, huh? You're testing me, my man, with all those questions that you already know the answers to." "What?" Suddenly, the old lady started laughing. She laughed and laughed until Hassan's blood started to run cold. The laugh was getting strange, sinister. She laughed hysterically now as her teeth yellowed. She shrieked and whooped, her eyes reddening at the rims and milky layers of skin covering her eyes. Her hair started to fall out as Hassan looked on, aghast at the sight of this vile creature. The woman cackled and gurgled as her laughter came to a stop. The sky darkened as rain clouds rushed overhead, and soon great thunderclaps crashed in the heavens as the rain fell, soaking them both. "The prophecy. The prophecy, Hassan." The woman shrieked, her mouth twisting into a vicious sneer, saliva spewing from her mouth and following the tracks of the rain. "Where have you hidden, Isis? Where?" Hassan's eyes darted everywhere wildly. "Isis? Where have you hidden me?" Hassan felt sick. He stood for a moment as something in his head, a light clicked on. Then he ran backwards and forwards on the bridge while the woman thrashed around in the storm, the rain transforming her into a demonic picture. "Isis? Isis? Remember. Remember. Remember me." The woman fell to the ground. She started to rasp horrible sounds. "Save me, Hassan." Hassan stopped in the middle of the bridge. "Isis. The wife of Osiris. She'd brought Osiris back to life. It was part of the puzzle, the great hieroglyph. Who was Isis in this grand picture?" Hassan paced again, then stopped thinking, remembering. Isis was the sixth sense. Isis was the part of us that just knew things without anybody telling us. Isis was his deep feelings about Egyptology, things that he knew in his heart, things that couldn't be proved, things that went against the normal stories that Egyptologists put into history books. Hassan had always known the truth in the hieroglyphs. He knew that the stories of human beings and the people who took over the world were hidden within other stories. You had to look deep in your heart to know the truth of ancient Egypt. Now, however, Hassan had to face that truth and be brave. He had to speak that truth now, and change history forever. He turned to the woman, who was no longer on the bridge. Looking around for her, Hassan realized the rain had stopped, the sky had darkened, and the half moon was out. It was a clear, beautiful night. He found her below the bridge, in the water. She was young, beautiful. Her flowing robes covered a pregnant stomach. Her long black silken hair reached her waist, and she threw a kiss from her lips to Hassan. "Do not hide your knowledge, Hassan. Do not sit facing the wrong direction. Do not feel comfortable with the lies the world has been told. You have one of the important keys of Amenti that you must share with the others. Listen carefully to the other Horus taskers. for they have keys to Amenti that you do not yet possess." The woman turned and walked downstream. Hassan watched her until she disappeared. Noah dangled helplessly. A movement from the corner of his eye alerted him to the tree branch from which he fell. Hovering there was the spider. Their eyes met. Noah was almost paralyzed at the thought of the thing paralyzing him. The spider put one of his legs forward. He seemed to be thinking of what? Noah wondered whether to come down now or not. Noah's eyes spun back to the cotton ball that was his double. "I thought you were finished off by the spider," Noah exclaimed. "Got to get your attention somehow." Noah's double laughed and flew up from the web to the tree opposite the giant spider. The silk cocoon was gone. Noah remained in his sticky prison. He tried to wriggle his arms, but the threads just seemed to wrap themselves further around his body, gluing him more firmly to the web. "You see what happens when you're not still, Noah? When you move too much. In your case, you talk too much, joke too much, tease too much. You're never serious. Never still. But why do I need to be a boring old drone?" "You don't. But you have to know yourself. You have to listen to yourself. Listen to what your heart tells you and to what your feelings tell you." "I never understand anything you say," Noah said miserably. His eyes wandered over to the spider, who still watched him with interest. "Your sister, Noah. Tell me about her." "Lara? She's well, my sister. What else is there to know? What is she like?" "Like all kid sisters. A pain, most of the time. She's weird, as well. She sees things. Strange things. Sometimes it's fun. A lot of the time she gets on everyone's nerves. Her weirdness is why I'm lying here right now." "But aren't you weird too, Noah?"
"Nope.
Not normally, anyway. On this trip, I've discovered a few things I can do, though. Sometimes, I think I'm going to wake up any minute and find myself at home in bed in England."
"You're the same as Lara, Noah, only you're too scared to admit it. You're stuck in this web because you were kidding yourself. You're making a lot of noise in your head, with all the jokes and quips, your fancy smart remarks. You were kind of creating a noisy web so you don't have to face the fact that you are like your sister. But, don't argue, Noah. That's just more noise, more webs. Slash, if you want to get out of here alive, think about what I'm saying. If you want to find Lara and the keys of Amenti, you have to admit that you have power. Admit that there's a lot more that you know about yourself. You can dream and travel with your mind. And you can see things if you want to. Be real, Noah. Know yourself and be yourself. Stop pretending you're ordinary and dull. Magic is everywhere. Magic belongs to all children and all adults if they care to remember and play with it." Noah lay in thought for a long time. When he opened his eyes, the jungle was gone, and he was lying on the hematite path in the great hall. Selene stood at the center of the labyrinth as each of them approached. The massive circular area was walled and, in the middle, was a huge six-pointed star. Melissa, Noah and Hassan stood at the entrance to the circle. Selene motioned for them to sit on stone seats, situated at the walls. She called Melissa to the center. "What have you learned about yourself, Melissa?" Melissa took a breath. "I have found self-belief. Self-belief is everything. We give away our power when we believe what we are told to believe. Our greatest proof of anything is our own experience, not other people's, or not so-called scientific experiment. When we experience something that others do not, we must honor it and learn about the world from it. Our experiences are important and they take us to many new and wonderful adventures in life. We do not need to convince others to believe us, for they have their own experiences and their own beliefs. We lose our power when we allow others to tell us our experiences do not mean anything." As Melissa finished, her body began to glow with a bright halo light. Selene took her hand and pulled her gently to stand at the center of the star. When Selene let go, Melissa disappeared. Noah was next. Selene looked at him closely. "What was your lesson, Noah?" "Self-knowledge. We have to know ourselves to know our power, we have to accept that we can see and feel things beyond the ordinary. We have many more senses than just the five physical senses. Sometimes, because we are surrounded by people who have forgotten this, we also make ourselves forget since we do not want to be different. Humans are powerful when they remember to use, or even train themselves to use, their forgotten gifts. We don't have to be ordinary. To be magical, we have to know our power, know ourselves. Standing at the center of the star, Noah released Selene's hand and disappeared through the portal. Hossam closed his eyes as he faced Selene. I have rediscovered personal truth. So often, we believe in something that others do not, yet we pretend to believe what they believe so we can be popular. We are scared to speak our own truth in case people stop liking us. But when we lie like this, we lose our power. Deep down we also do not feel good about ourselves because we keep changing who we are to be like everyone else. This means we never get to the truth because everyone always has different ideas about things. When we have the courage to say what we think, we become strong. We always know which path to follow because we believe in the truth inside of us that tells us what to do for the best. Hassan felt light as he let go of Selene's hand and passed through the portal. Squinting in the semi-darkness of the tunnel, he found his two travel companions. They looked at each other and smiled happily. Like three glowing angels in the black of night, they sank to the floor of the dim corridor to consider their next move.